from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, Pope Francis named his newest cardinals, many from developing and underrepresented countries, none from the U.S. It's the latest move in a papacy not short of surprises, shaped by his beginnings as Jorge Bergoglio, a young Jesuit in Argentina, amid Peronism, Argentina's dirty war, focused on the poor, not power and wealth. As the new year begins, this pope is still revving up on Vatican reforms, on climate change, on flipping the omelet, as he says, of world priorities. Catholics and plenty of non-Catholics are paying attention. This hour, On Point, understanding Pope Francis. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you read this smiling pope? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Austin Ivory, Catholic, journalist, well-known commentator. He did an Oxford PhD on religion and politics in Argentina, pretty relevant. He's out with a big new biography, The Great Reformer, Francis, and the Making of a Radical Pope. Austin Ivory, thank you very much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Rome, Phil Pulella is here, senior Italy and Vatican correspondent for Reuters. Phil, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much for having me, Tom. Hello, Austin.
Hi, Phil.
Austin, Phil, it's great to have both of you with us. Austin, take us in right away here and back to Argentina, your area of expertise. What is it in the origins of this pope to an Italian immigrant family in Argentina that you point to that may begin to explain his, may I say, unique approach to the papacy?
Well, I think he's a pope who has always said from the beginning that he wants the voice of the margins from the peripheries to be heard and to some extent to shape the church. And that's really been his conviction from a very early age. Why does he particularly come up with this, have this conviction? Well, I think it's partly his experience of being the child of recently arrived immigrants in Argentina. So he was familiar with the pain, the suffering, the expectation, the fragility of the poor, jobs, migration, those kinds of things which are of deep concern to ordinary people were always his. And then I suppose you'd have to say also because he's a Jesuit. He was a Jesuit for 30 years. He always wanted to be a Jesuit as a young man, even though he didn't know them. He was attracted to the idea of mission, to the periphery, of being on the edge of things, of being in dialogue with culture. He wasn't afraid of the world. And he always did have, his family says, a very deep appreciation for, concern for ordinary people and the poor. And you see that now every Wednesday in his general audiences, when the first thing he does is go out among the crowd and make the ordinary people a protagonist.
Phil, we've got a smiling pope here, a humble pope who doesn't wear the fancy slippers, a foot-washing pope. Of course, that has very long roots in Christian tradition. Nevertheless, there's a very new face being presented here. Is the crackling excitement around this pope because of the theater of his papacy, Phil, or is he changing things in a material, significant way?
No, I think it is not show. He is changing things in a significant way. I think that one of the things that we always have to keep in mind, obviously, is that we always compare him to his predecessor. And I know that some in the media get a lot of criticism for doing that, but that's the reality of the situation. He's very different from his predecessor. He is much more similar to John Paul II. And I've always maintained that if he had been elected in 2005 instead of Pope Benedict to succeed Pope John Paul, his papacy would have been different, at least at the start, because it would have been in many ways similar to the start of John Paul's papacy, because it was just such a surprise, the first non-Italian pope in 450 years, the first pope from the other side of the Iron Curtain, etc. But getting back to your question, I think that it is more substance and not just style. He does have deep intentions on changing things. It will depend on how much he is able to change. It will depend, of course, on how long he lives, which is true for all of us. We all want to make changes and do things, but it depends on how much time we have on Earth. And if he has that time, I do believe that he will make changes in the Vatican and beyond. as some of the choices that you mentioned earlier yesterday and the choices of cardinals showed. He does sometimes look like and seem like a man who is in a hurry. He's not yet 2 years into his papacy, and he has done an enormous amount of things. He reminds me very, very much of John Paul at the beginning, particularly after the assassination attempt against John Paul in May of 1981, where it seems that he wanted to get a lot done because he felt that he had little time left. As it turned out, he had nearly 24 years left after that assassination attempt, but he came very, very close to dying, and so he did put his foot on the pedal.
Phil, where would you point as a kind of punch list of the most substantive steps that this pope has taken or appears ready to take, substantive?
Well, I think the Curia reform is on the reform of the central administration of the Roman Catholic Church here in the Vatican, which is known as the Curia, is well on its way, and I think we will see some changes in how those departments operate in the next year. Now, it may seem to some like this is inside baseball, but it's really not inside baseball because the decisions that are taken in those apartments, inside the Vatican actually do have an effect on the church, which has 1.2 billion members. So those kind of things will have an effect. They will be felt in the pews. There are other issues that have been concrete, if you want, bringing attention to some of the major problems in the world. He has spoken often about the problems of human trafficking. Mm-hmm. We expect an encyclical this year on the environment. The Vatican stresses that this is on creation, not the environment, but that's just semantics.
Climate change is the anticipated
climate change
subject.
Will be part of that. We don't know how much mm-hmm. will be part of that. Perhaps you want to talk about that in detail later on. Mm-hmm. Reform of Vatican finances. Already a lot has been done, a lot has to be done still. Those are some of the issues that come to mind immediately to answer your question, Tom.
Austin, help us understand how this pope moves here. Is he moving solo? I mean, he was elected, so he's got people behind him. Does he have a party within the church, a posse of strong supporters within the church? Is there a kitchen cabinet who he leans on for guidance or sort of political support within the church? How is he configured in that way?
The way I'd answer that question is actually as a supplement to what Phil was just saying.
Yes.
About the curial reform. I think the really big reform, the thing that will really last and reshape the church for generations, is the reform in what I call governance of the church. It's not just, in other words, what happens in Rome. It's about how the decisions are actually made that affect the whole church. Now, what Francis is doing is bringing in, if you like, bringing the local church into the universal. One of the first things he did was appoint a kitchen cabinet, a council of eight, now nine cardinals, and he tasked them with the task of reforming the Curia. Now they're the ones who in February are going to be reporting and saying, look, this is the radical restructuring of the Vatican that we propose. But what's significant about this is that the cardinals who have come up with this are themselves leaders of local churches. They're heads of bishops' conferences in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America. Now this is the really big thing. Now this is Francis's, if you like, where is his power base? How does he move the thing? What he does is he's going outside the traditional structures of power and if you like, bringing in the base from which, if you like, he comes from. Now, he's a master political strategist. It's one of the things I hope that comes out of my book, The Great Reformer, mm-hmm. is that he's an extraordinary mixture of, if you like, Desert Saint and Machiavelli. And so he understands power, he understands strategy. That doesn't make him any less holy or any less dedicated to God's will, but he knows how to make things happen. So one of the things he's doing is if you like, taking that power away from the Curia and giving it to the bishops. Another way he's doing this is through the Synod. The Synod is a meeting of bishops which used to happen every 3 years and didn't really produce much because it came up with the answers that the Vatican ultimately wanted it to come up with. Francis has changed that. He's given the bishops of the world a very serious task of discerning, of deciding very enormous pastoral questions. And at the end of the process, which is next October, there will be pastoral strategies, as it were, that the whole Church has come up with, which the Vatican will then be implementing, bypassing, if you like, the traditional way, which is, if you like, Pope telling the bishops what to do via the Vatican.
He said the Vatican is sick with power and greed. That's pretty tough talk. What's his vision? What's the mission that he's putting the spade work at the Vatican to work for or toward, Austin?
No, I think that was reported, understandably, but I think wrongly, as Francis criticizing the Vatican. What he was doing was asking the Vatican, and by extension the whole Church, to do a kind of examination of conscience. He's saying, look, if you want to represent the gospel, if you want to further the gospel here, you know, these are the things we have to avoid, this is what we have to be. It's like every Christian needs to do that. They examine their conscience, they see how, if you like, they're blocking God and how. That's what he was doing. Now, why was he doing it? And of course, it was in very, very strong language. This was just before Christmas, listing these 15 spiritual ills and so on, is that actually he wants the Vatican to model the Church. He doesn't want the Vatican to be an obstacle to evangelization. He wants the Vatican to serve the cause of evangelization, and that means making, in many ways, Rome the model, you know, for the rest of the Church, the example. So this is its behavior change that he's trying to introduce here, according to, if you like, quite old-fashioned, actually, spiritual, radical spiritual reform criteria.
Here is the Pope, this was last week, saying Mass in St. Peter's Basilica, marking the 48th World Day of Peace.
Deus, qui salutis eterne beate Maria Virgine Natate Feconda, humano generi premia prestitisti.
We're talking this hour about Pope Francis, the most compelling new figure to come on the world stage in a long time, and what drives him. I'm Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, we'll be right back. Talking this hour about Pope Francis. Lots of people paying attention to this Pope and his, it can feel like, unique approach to the papacy. A Pope out of Latin America, out of Argentina. Austin Ivory is out with a big new biography, The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. He joins us today from London. And Phil Pallella is with us from Rome, senior Italy and Vatican correspondent for Reuters. Austin, Phil, lots of response here from our listeners. Judy says, a pope who considers himself a pastor, not an emperor, and one who follows Jesus. She's into it. True says, I think the Vatican got more than they bargained for, and in this case, that seems to be a very good thing. Carlotta, I'm a fallen away Catholic / atheist, but I love this guy. And Nancy, I loved him from the moment he refused to wear those asinine red velvet shoes. Well, I mean, okay, there's all kinds of ways of walking. He is walking in quite a new way, Phil. He's not even living in the Pope's apartment.
Yes, this is one of the I remember when we were first told nearly 2 years ago that he decided that he just wasn't going back. And I mean, I've been covering the Vatican for almost more than 30 years now. And I thought it was a joke. I thought that the Vatican spokesman was pulling our legs, but it's true. He did not want to live in the papal apartments. Now, the papal apartments, I've been in them. They are not luxurious. They are very spacious. We've gone up there to receive heads of states and things like that. But he said that he would go crazy psychologically. He would affect them psychologically if he had to live there, because he needs to live in a community, which says a lot about his background. As a person who grew up in a family, which Austin was talking about before, people need company, and then as a Jesuit who needs to live in a community, he needs to see people so he feels more comfortable with seeing people. And apart from that, he doesn't want to be isolated to make these decisions in total isolation. He wants to see people, even people who are at a much lower level, who go in and out of the place where he's living in the Vatican now, in a rather small apartment. I think it's probably smaller than mine. And so that is the kind of person that he is. He had the courage to break those kinds of tradition. I think that someone like John Paul probably was tempted to do something like that, but maybe didn't feel it was the right time.
There's this wonderful phrase, Austin, you'll have to remind me of something. This Pope has said he wants to, what is it, the moon comes into play. He doesn't want to be the church to be the sun, but rather the moon.
Well, yes. Well, this comes from a famous speech he gave on the eve of the conclave to the other cardinals. Remember that the cardinals gathered for over a week to consider, you know, the kind of man that was needed for the kind of for the moment. Mm-hmm. And he talked about the importance of living, as it were, from the light of Christ. And he used an analogy from the early church, indeed, about living on from the light of the moon. This has been his thing.
Reflecting the source, not being the source of authority.
Exactly. So, in other words, the church exists to reflect God, to reflect Christ. As soon as it comes to believe that it actually is its own light, that it itself sheds light, then that's where disaster happens. That's where the church becomes an obstacle, an idol, if you like, rather than actually being a vehicle for God. So it was an extraordinary speech. I call it in the book a sort of papal Gettysburg, because it was very short. In fact, it's one of the few speeches in those days which came in at less than the allotted 4 minutes. But it made a huge impact on the cardinals that were there, because I think it really did nail the crisis. It nailed the moment for those cardinals. And really what he was saying was, look, you know, the church exists to evangelize. It must go out there. It must, if you like, take the light out. It must have contact with the peripheries, where human need is, where existential need is. That's where the church must be, rather than, as it were, existing for itself, for its own benefit, and living by its own light. So he contrasted what he called the self-referential church with the evangelizing church. And it really struck a chord, because I think so many of the crises of the Vatican in recent years, which, you know, Phil and his colleagues have covered so brilliantly, actually are crises, if you like, of an institution which has been for too long self-enclosed, closed in on itself. And that's true, actually, not just of the Vatican, but in many ways of the Church of the Northern Hemisphere. So one of the stories, actually, of Francis' accession to the papacy is that he brings with him a church which is, in fact, incredibly missionary and evangelizing, precisely because it is a church, as it were, for the poor and of the poor, in contrast to the Church of the North, the US, Northern Europe, which can often have a language as if it's persecuted and beleaguered and threatened, when in reality, you know, it doesn't face the kind of challenges which exist in most third world countries, where Catholicism is a much more, you know, energetic and joyful enterprise. So this is partly the culture shock. It's not just about, you know, the red shoes and not living in the Apostolic Palace. There's a much kind of deeper culture shock, if you like, going on, not dissimilar to what Phil was talking about in the early days of John Paul II, who, you know, came from the East and came from outside the world of Italy. But this is, as it were, a wind from the South, which Francis is bringing with him, much more direct, much more, if you like, speaks to the heart, relies less on reason and more on the heart, is much more direct, if you like, much more, I can say this as a European talking to Americans, it's much more kind of, you know, Republican in the Americans. It's more new world than old world. It's modernity rather than, you know, ancient court. And so that's why it feels, even though substantively, actually, you know, we, as I'm sure we're going to go on to talk about, one might say Francis isn't changing very much, you know, substantively in terms of doctrine, I think. And yet there is a very different feel about this papacy, which, because of the culture, the church, the background that he brings with him.
Republican as in Republic, not monarchy. Let's hear it from our listeners.
The contrast I was drawing.
Yes, indeed. And then I want to go to Argentina and back to those Jesuit roots. But first, a few of our listeners here. Kirsten in Charlotte, North Carolina. Kirsten, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you see?
I was raised Catholic, and I haven't been to church in decades. I'm very disillusioned with their old world nature and the way the doctrine has been handled, you know, throughout my lifetime. And Francis makes me pay attention to them and gives me a kind of hope that change could come to the church and might actually bring me back.
Actually, put you in a pew?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I could if they can change some things. I mean, I'd like to see some substantive changes, as, you know, we're not really getting that, but certainly for the face of the church, and that the church should be working for the poor. I mean, that's their function. That's exactly what Jesus asked us to do. And you know, the gold trappings and the red shoes and all that, and the power structure is just too much to believe in.
If he's evangelizing, it sounds like it may be working with you, Kirsten, and I'm glad for your call. I appreciate it very much. One more right here. Newport, Rhode Island, Brian's calling. Kirsten, thank you. Brian, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Pope Francis, I find most inspiring, and I find him very, very human, very, very much appealing as a lifelong Catholic, educated in Catholic grammar school and high school and college.
Yeah.
I have even wandered and found myself not always the militant soldier of Jesus Christ, as we may have learned, but something more from our catechisms, which I do follow and see expressed in Pope Francis' administration of his office, is that the one holy Catholic and apostolic church, as we were taught to know the words that describe Catholicism, is in the universality in his new move with the appointment of more than, I believe it's approaching 50 cardinals or closer to 30, somewhere a figure like that, but in the Southern Hemisphere, more universalizing and bringing more people into the vineyard, you know?
Yes, we do, Brian. I mean, 15 new cardinals just over this weekend. Let me take that to Austin and the Pope's Jesuit background. You write at some length in The Great Reformer, your biography, about how that comes into play in, has come into play in shaping Pope Francis' view of the world and the church and morality. Help us, those of us who aren't schooled in that realm, Austin, make the connection between how we see him pursuing the papacy or executing it and that background.
There are many of the great reforming popes of the church's history have come from the religious orders. That's to say, not from the diocesan clergy, you know, your local parish priest mm-hmm. who then becomes a bishop. The religious orders and the monasteries and orders like the Franciscans, the Dominicans and the Jesuits. Now, what makes religious different from secular clergy is that they are committed to poverty. So they live simply and therefore they are, if you like, outside the structures of the power. So I think that's one big thing. Mm-hmm. But one very, very crucial thing about Francis to understand is that he is a creature of the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola. St. Ignatius was the 16th century founder of the Jesuits, who created really this bombshell evangelization tool, which was like a kind of portable desert. It's a four-week conversion experience. It's a retreat that you can do anywhere in the middle of a city as well as in the middle of a desert, as it were. And you have a spiritual guide who takes you through a series of meditations. Now, it's divided into weeks, both literally and metaphorically. The first week is all about experiencing the knowledge that you are a sinner, but at the same time unconditionally loved and forgiven by God.
Is this for
and
that priests, experience, Austin? Is this for priests?
No, it's absolutely, if anybody can do it. I've done it. Lay people do it all the time. The Jesuits run many retreat houses mm-hmm. where they make the spiritual exercises available. Most people do it initially just for 4 days or a week. The big thing is the month-long one. Mm-hmm. The point about the first week, though, is that you have this experience of the loving forgiveness of God, and in the second week, you choose. You make your choice, as it were, for Christ. You reject the temptations of this world. You resist the temptation, the lure of power and wealth and status, and choose, in fact, to follow Christ. That's where you make your choice. Now, the order is very, very important here, because without the first week, as it were, you don't get to the second week. And this is his conviction. His conviction is that actually people need to first experience the love and the mercy and the saving, healing power of God before they are able, if you like, to accept the truth of Christianity. And his discernment, which is a very Jesuit word, of the church at the moment, is that we've been very good, as it were, at putting the second week before the first week. We tell people what's true, but we don't. People don't perceive the loving, merciful, forgiving side, which is why he proclaimed from the very beginning, from when he was on the plane back from Rio de Janeiro, his first major trip outside, he proclaimed a kairos of mercy, a new God's time, as it were, of mercy. Why does he keep banging on so much about mercy? Because this is his conviction. This is what he thinks the world. So hence he talks about the church needing to be like a battlefield hospital, one that knows how to come alongside people, tend to their wounds, you know, to speak from the heart to people. Because only when they know that and they experience that will they be ready to see the rest of it. Now, a number of you, you know, your callers already, but you know, so many people have said, this Pope, I love this guy. I'm not a Catholic. I don't believe a lot of the stuff that the Catholic Church says, but I love this guy. Actually, what they're responding to, I think, is this, if you like, this capacity of the popes to simply demonstrate, to be a channel for that warmth and that love.
Does it make everything else that's in doctrine palatable to modern palates, Phil, if the Pope begins with this more merciful, open, smiling approach?
Well, certainly you do have a number of Catholics and others who were not thrilled with some of the things that he are doing, that he has done and is doing. Just for example, the first time that he attended the foot washing ceremony on Holy Thursday last year, and he went not only he did it outside the Vatican for the first time in living memory, went to a jail, and included not only women in the group of 12 that whose feet he kissed and washed, which is a gesture that commemorates Christ's gesture to his apostles on the night before he died. There were not only women, and but there was a woman who was actually a Muslim. Now, this is a tradition that he had carried, that he had begun as Archbishop of Buenos Aires, and he saw no reason why he should not continue it. And I'm sure there are people in the Vatican who said, you shouldn't do this, because traditionally, you know, this is going to send wrong signals. Women shouldn't be there. A Muslim shouldn't be there. Jesus had apostles who were only men, etc. And he said, well, it's fine. Thank you for your opinion, probably. I'm going to do it anyway. And he just went out and did it. And I'm sure that conservatives were not very happy about that. There are things that in this papacy that are not pleasing to everybody. I'd like to differ slightly from what Austin said before about the significance of what he told the Curia, because I'm sure that somebody in the Curia, when he made that decision to go to the reformatory and do that Holy Thursday celebration, someone told him probably not to do it. The Curia, the speech he gave to the Curia before Christmas was, I think, it was, as Austin said, that everybody should do an examination of conscience. But he did this after 2 years, almost 2 years of being Pope, after having read the secret report, which was commissioned by former Pope Benedict, about what was going on inside the Vatican administration, which led to Vatti leaks and which also led to Benedict's own resignation. There were a lot of things that should not have happened in there, and his critique was so precise and point by point by point that it became necessary for him to do that. And I think that one of the questions it begs now is that he wants to reform the Curia, but he needs the Curia in order to reform it. Having read them the Riot Act in such a way, he's basically criticizing the very people that he is going to need to put those reforms into practice. But he obviously feels that that change is important enough that he had to do it that way, and he will go forward.
Austin, how does he do that? How does he? I mean, this is the horse he's riding. There are others, I suppose you could say, hitched alongside. But this is the administration of the Catholic Church. Is there a wholesale house cleaning? Does he work with the people who are there and somehow imagine that he will change their ways?
Well, I mean, Phil's absolutely right. It is very striking when you go to Rome, as I've been a number of times this year, and you talk to curial officials and you discover that Francis is a whole lot less popular in Rome than he is outside it. One of the things, of course, that bureaucrats want is a little bit of certainty. They like a certain kind of order. And there's one thing about Francis is he's a deeply disconcerting leader. This, is, again, has been a pattern throughout his life. You never know what he's going to do next. He plays his cards very, very close to his chest. He does have, you were asking me earlier about, you know, who is around him. I mean, he does have people he relies on who are he deeply trusts and, in fact, devolves to. In that sense, he's not a centralizer, although in other ways he is, because, in fact, that's how he operates. He operates through these people that he trusts rather than through the bureaucratic systems. Now, will he do it? I think it is an open question. I think by the end of this year, we will know whether he's pulled it off. And I do think it'll be by the end of this year that we'll know, because the implementation of the curial shakeup is going to be crucial, as Phil says. I mean, if he doesn't actually carry people with him, then the whole thing could indeed be endangered. But I do think, if you're asking me to guess, I think he will pull it off, because he, looking at his past, looking at how he operates, what he does is he, of course, he's deeply critical of the faults that need to be corrected, but he's also deeply affirming. He builds relationships of trust with people, and I know he is building those relationships all the time at the moment in the Vatican, and there are a lot of people who are really behind him.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Pope Francis his impact, his message, his vision, and the roots of his motivations this hour with Austin Ivory, author of The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope, joins us from London. Phil Pulella is here. From Rome, he covers the Vatican for Reuters. Yes, the Pope has been tough on the Vatican itself. Here he is in December in Christmas remarks before the Roman Curia.
There is also the sickness of the stony mind and spirit, of those who along the way lose their inner serenity, their vivacity, and their audacity, and end up hiding behind papers, becoming machines for practices and not men of God.
His critique there of life and the way the workings within the Vatican, but he's gone well beyond that. Here's Scott Pelley, 60 Minutes paying attention, everybody paying attention to this Pope. This is Scott Pelley interpreting a little of the Pope on what we pay attention to in this world.
This is what gets through today. If investments in the banks and elsewhere drop a little, oh tragedy, what can we do? But if people die of hunger, if they're sick, no, none of that gets through.
Austin, Phil, lots of response here. Crowgirl42 on Twitter says, seems amazing to me that a man can do so little and get so much praise for it. All right, but here's another. Michigan says, Pope Francis is one of the only a few truly significant voices countering the rampant greed of the wealthy worldwide, voices especially lacking in the U.S. Is that what he's talking about, Austin, when he talks about flipping the omelet?
Yes, his perception is that we've got it all wrong, that we've been, as it were, dulled and deadened by our consumerism and by a particular model which makes one part of the world consistently rich and overall, of course, produces economic growth worldwide, but which also produces long-term unemployment and poverty and creates also a mindset. And here's his real criticism. The mindset goes something like this. You don't have to, as it were, address the question of poverty because sooner or later the market will sort it out. In other words, if there are poor people, that's just teething problems and we'll get there in the end. He says that's just not true. There's no such thing actually as trickle down. The glass just gets bigger. It never trickles down. So here's where his really powerful critique of a contemporary model of globalized capitalism, which is directly, I think, confronting a certain mentality, which I think is particularly prevalent in the US, where there is great hostility on the part of some to any kind of effort by governments or public bodies to do something about income distribution. So, yeah, very, very definite critique there. But actually, as I'm sure Phil will agree, I mean, in a way, this is nothing new. He's coming out of a social Catholic tradition, which has always been critical, both, if you like, of communism, of statism, but also of a certain kind of liberal individualistic capitalism,
Phil Pelley,
which ignores the poor.
Yeah, Phil, in Rome, what is expected from the Pope when he visits the United States this year? What message?
Well, I think that some of the things that Austin just mentioned, that you mentioned, and also that soundbite about the power of noblesse oblige, in a sense, if you want to put it in a sort of a very small term, very small phrase. I mean, basically, those who have wealth and power have to do more to help those who do not have it. It's as simple as that. And I do think that that will be a major theme of the trip to the States in September, as well as a lot of North-South issues of not neglecting other countries and helping other countries. I mean, basically, this has been a theme, as Austin said. Some of the things that he is saying is not anything new, in the sense that John Paul went to the United States and basically said the same things about, you know, a country that has been as blessed as the United States has been throughout its history, that it is as rich as the United States is, has to look after the rest of the world as much as possible, just as a rich uncle, if you will, if you want me to be, would look after some of the poorer members of the family. Again, just make believe that they don't exist. I think that will be one of the main themes. And obviously consumerism will also be one of the main themes. Family will be one of the main themes in the United States as well. The importance of the family as a nucleus of society. Are we forgetting that? Is it being disintegrated by consumerism, by the rush for you become rich at all costs? Do we spend enough time with people? The internet society. There are people who are, you know, connected 24 hours a day, 36 hours a day. He said in one of the criticisms to the cardinals is saying, take some time off. take a walk. Don't stay behind a desk all the time. Well, that is obviously much, much more applicable to a wealthy society than it is to a poorer country. And I think those are some of the themes that we will see in September, which, as you probably know, will not just include Philadelphia. It's not official yet, but it will most probably include New York, where he will address the United Nations, and a trip to Washington, because he's also been invited by President Obama as well as Congress to make an address to the joint houses of Congress. It's not official yet, but it's almost definite, people here saying that those two cities will also be included on this tour. So it will be a rather important trip, because it will be also to the center of economic power in the United States, New York, the center of political power in Washington, and he's going there for an international meeting on families. And so we're basically going to be combining those three things. And that will make it an even more important trip.
That will be fascinating. Talk about a big megaphone and a big platform. Austin, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I think one of the things that we haven't yet seen too much of from Francis, but we are going to see on this U.S. trip, is he also has a very, very, he has a lot to say about politics and about the revitalization, the renewal of public life. He did this already when he went to Strasbourg, when he addressed the European Parliament, famously likened the European Union to an aging grandmother. He has, as my research shows, a huge background in this. He's done a lot of thinking about politics and the way civil society can renew the state and so on. I think we're going to get a really powerful challenge to America's political class for its, if you like, detachment from the ordinary concerns and priorities of ordinary people. And that's something I think we won't be expecting from a pope.
Americans who will want to judge the credibility of that critique, if and when it comes, Austin, may well need a short course in this pope's time during the dirty war in Argentina. You spend a lot of time on that in your book, The Great Reformer. Take us back there. Give us your settle into that a little bit and talk about what his responsibilities were during that time, the cases that came to be very controversial that have left lingering criticism of the pope in his home country, Argentina, for his relationship with a very tough government in those days. Set the scene, what was going on in the 70s and how this, not then pope, but Jesuit leader maneuvered through it, Austin.
The 1970s in Argentina was a time of political and ideological polarization. This is the period when he was elected a very young provincial, that's the head of the local Jesuits, at the age of just 36. In 1973, he was elected in the middle of a crisis within the order, which in that crisis in part reflected the ideological polarization within the order, within the church, and within the country at large. What was going on was a kind of political breakdown where the country's largest party, which was the Peronists, were excluded from power by the military government. Perón was then allowed back, and it was a disastrous government, then followed by an even more brutal another military government. In the middle of all of this, you had the biggest, at the time, the Western Hemisphere's largest guerrilla army, many of which was, much of its language was very Catholic, in fact. It was a nationalist Catholic guerrilla, which was had, however, a kind of Marxist-Cuban type analysis of what it wanted was, if you like, a left-wing goal. Mm-hmm. So this was the context in which he was trying to steer his order. And then in 1976, when the military government comes in, it decides, with the support, by the way, of the political parties and indeed the unions and everybody else, to deal with the guerrilla threat, but does so using these phenomenally brutal methods which result in the deaths, the systematic torture.
Kidnapping, disappearance, torture, yes.
Kidnapping, disappearance, torture of something like 9,000 people is the final kind of agreed figure. Now, this was a brutal time and a brutal era and a brutal government. The accusations against him, as against the Catholic Church in general, was that they didn't do enough, that they didn't speak out. And there's a lot of truth to that. And Bergoglio himself would later say, as Cardinal, would lead the Catholic Church's, you know, asking for forgiveness, that they didn't do enough. But what I try and do in the book is I do actually situate this in the moment, which is in 1976, faced with this massive guerrilla threat. Everybody basically supported, you know, that government and what it was trying to do. What they didn't obviously realise, to the extent that they, as became clear later, was the kind of methods involved. Now, Bergoglio himself...
Well, not everyone supported the government, certainly. Some of the Jesuits who were affiliated with the now Pope himself did not support that government.
Well,
slum priests, as they were known.
There was a group who were ideologically committed to the guerrillas. Obviously, they didn't support the military government. The point I was just trying to make was that, if you like, the political classes, the media, middle-class Argentina generally, there was just strong public support for the military government, not necessarily, obviously, for the methods which it deployed. But what did people like Bergoglio try to do? What he was trying to do was two things, which were actually in tension. He was trying to protect the Jesuits from the military government, precisely because many of the Jesuits were, at least ideologically, sympathetic with the guerrillas. And on the other hand, he was actually trying to directly help the victims of the regime, you know, hiding them. Now, these two things were in tension. Had the government known that he was hiding people fleeing the regime, the Jesuits would have been in a much more insecure place. But he pulled it off, and he did so, as I explain in the book, because he did play his cards very close to his chest because of the relationships that he had and so on. What is quite wrong is to say that he was in any way ideologically sympathetic to the military government. He was not. He was equally, if you like, aboard both the left-wing guerrillas and the right-wing government. And it's true that he didn't speak out, but of course, had he spoken out, and very few people did, and when they did, they were usually exiled or suppressed, that had he spoken out, he wouldn't have been able to achieve either of his other two objectives, which he did achieve. And one of the things he did, and it's revealed not just in my book, but in other research that's been done, is that he helped dozens of people who were fleeing the regime, not just sheltering them in the big college that he ran, but he actually helped them to get them out of the country. So yes, in many ways, I mean, he himself would accuse himself of not doing enough, because in a way, in that situation, if you've ever been in a totalitarian regime, it's impossible to do enough, and you're always left with a feeling of guilt that you haven't done more. But he did do a lot.
Why has the critique of his failings continued to resonate over all these years? 1976 is a long time ago, and yet this theme is still out there.
There was a specific allegation made against him in respect of two Jesuits who were abducted by the military from the shanty town where they worked in Buenos Aires. Now, it was later believed by those two Jesuits, particularly by one of them, that Bergoglio, as provincial, had failed to protect them sufficiently, had failed to give them, if you like, sufficient support that would have protected them from being abducted. Now, and then that accusation I show in my book actually grew over time and became caught up with a kind of 1980s narrative about the church being complicit with the regime, until it actually became very, very distorted and became far more serious, actually, than those Jesuits involved had ever actually alleged. Those Jesuits themselves, at least one of them, the one of them who survived, came later to see that that was quite untrue, that the reason that they had been abducted really had nothing to do at all with Bergoglio. And as I show in my account, he actually did an awful lot to try and protect those two Jesuits. They were very headstrong. They were actually on their way out of the order. They did not want to move when he asked them to move. And so you actually have a very complex internal dispute within the Jesuits, which had a lot to do, actually, not with ideology so much as a view of religious life, which will then gets caught up with all those accusations and allegations. I must say, looking at this, I know that, you know, from what I'm saying, it sounds like he wasn't guilty of anything. Well, you know, as I say, he believed that he could have done more. Nobody comes out of that period, you know, as a knight in shining armour. But I think, actually, he's been investigated now by, you know, by judges, and these allegations were raked over in various hearings as well when he was cardinal. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the consensus among journalists and human rights investigators, at least most of them, is that he has nothing to apologize for.
Phil, how do you feel this Pope's Latin American roots, his Argentine roots, at work in his papacy?
Well, it's because he comes from the south of the world that it has basically colored his view on everything, and absolutely everything, because he's the first non-European in 1,300 years, and that's a long time. Mm. Even John Paul, I keep referring to John Paul because he was an incredibly historic figure, but he came from the east, but he came from a country which is now part of the European Union. It was right on the other side of its culture. Was very European. He's got a completely different take on things. He grew up in a different period of time. He went through the Depression down in Argentina, and everything that he lived through down there. And as a young man, and then as a Jesuit, colors the way he sees the world. He's looking at it from the south, and everybody before has been looking at it from the north, from here. when he says something like the soundbite that you played before about if the market goes down 2 points, it's a tragedy and it's the lead item on the news. Mm-hmm. If a man dies of frostbite outside on the streets of Rome, it's not news. I mean, that comes from some very specific experiences that he had in Buenos Aires when he used to go visit the shanty towns constantly and saw poverty all around him. So coming from the South and coming from Latin America and colors his view of the world and also his view of the developed world. So surely someone who comes mm-hmm. from South America sees the United States, for example, in a certain way, and it is not the same way as someone who comes from Europe sees. So this is also coloring, tinging his criticism of capitalism, for example, of the unbridled capitalism, of the excesses of capitalism, in a different way than it colored John Paul's view.
Austin, we've just got a minute here. What do you expect from his trip to the U.S.? What message do you anticipate will be top of his agenda?
I think he's going to speak on behalf of the people who he reckons are too often left over or ignored in the U.S. He'll be speaking, I think, for undocumented migrants. He'll be speaking for the poor. He'll be speaking for the victims also of the death penalty. I think it'll be a prophetic call to the heart, to the soul of America. You know, in the end, he is an American. He's the son of the new world. And there's so much between this Pope and Americans that I think, you know, that they have in common. And I think it's going to be a very, very important moment in his papacy and a very important moment for the United States.
Big year ahead after already remarkable beginnings for Pope Francis. Austin Ivory joined us from London. He's author of the new biography, The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. Austin, let's talk again. Thank you very much for being here today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
And Phil Pallella, senior Italy and Vatican correspondent for Reuters in Rome. Phil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.